the book of Esther, chapter 2. Reading the whole of the chapter, starting from verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, and the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her when the king's palace for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day, Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation, according to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her, from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shasgas, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abigail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go in to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, 2 of the king's eunuchs, Bitham and Teresh, doorkeepers became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. We come to this second study on the book of Esther. In the previous study, we have seen already that the events of the book of Esther took place in the 58 years between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. There was this gap. If you study through the book of Ezra, you see that chapter 1 to chapter 6 cover a certain period, and chapter 7 to chapter 10 cover a certain period, but there was this gap of 58 years between chapter 6 and chapter 7. What happened during that period? The events that are recorded in the book of Esther happened during this 58 years of silence. Now, the events happened round about the year, the 5th century, in the round about the time when this man Ahasuerus became king. He became king from 485 to 464 BC. So remember, before the coming of Christ, we count downwards. So 485 to 464, that period of time. And in chapter 1, we saw what happened. The queen, Queen Vashti, a beautiful woman, was summoned by the king during a feast to parade her beauty before the men. And Vashti made a stand. She refused to come forward to be paraded like a piece of jewel. So the king was, of course, upset and lost face in front of all the dignitaries of the empire. Remember Ahasuerus, or Xerxes the First in Greek. Ahasuerus was an emperor ruling over a vast empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember, Babylon was ruling, then Babylon fell. Then the Medes and Persians together formed the next empire. And the Medes and Persians occupied what is today's Iran. And in those days, the Medo-Persian Empire extended over a vast area from North India all the way sweeping across to North Africa. So we see that Ahasuerus was a very powerful emperor. And at that time, he was holding a feast because he had just won a major battle against the Egyptians. And he was making preparations to fight against the Greeks. The nation of Greece was coming into power, rising fast. And Ahasuerus thought of conquering Greece before it became too powerful. So he was celebrating his victory over the Egyptians and making preparations for the attack on the Greeks. And that accounted for the feast that was held. And because Vashti, the queen, refused to obey the king, so the king had to remove her by the advice of the dignitaries of the nation, by his counselors. So the counselor said that Vashti was setting a bad example for all the women in the empire. What if the word gets out to all the women folk throughout the empire? They hear of Vashti going against the king's command. Then all the women would also go against their husbands. So you must remove Vashti, they claim. So the king at that time just listened to the dignitaries and counselors, and he removed Vashti from being queen. But when he became sober, he regretted it, but it was too late because a decree by a Persian king could not be undone. So once it's decreed, it was carried out. So that was the background to today's study. So today we come to this second chapter of the book of Esther. We come to this message, Faithless Compromise. We are talking about the compromise of this man called Mordecai, who was faithless in the sense that he had grown cold spiritually, and God had to revive him after this occasion. Now we continue on from where we left off. What happened was that Xerxes, after that, Ahasuerus, after that, attacked the Greeks, but he failed. From secular history, we know that. Then he attacked again, and again he was unable to defeat them. So he suffered two major defeats at the hands of the Greeks in the year 480 BC. And the events of chapter 2 took place round about that time. And it was 4 years after the sacking of Vashti, the removal of the queen Vashti. So the queen Vashti was removed, then Ahasuerus went to fight the Greeks, and then he was unsuccessful. He came back defeated, very depressed. So this story happened round about that time, and it involved also a major player, Mordecai, who had this adopted daughter, who actually was his cousin. So in some families, you know that although you're of the same generation, the age gap can be quite big. And it happened in this case that Mordecai was an adult, and his cousin Esther was an orphan, was much younger. So since Mordecai did not have any children, he adopted this Esther and took her in. And so he of course loved Esther and raised her up well. And the events of chapter 2 occurred and involved these two persons, Mordecai and his adopted daughter Esther. Now they were put under severe trials because of the political situations of the time, but through this severe trial they emerged and became useful in God's service. And we are going to learn from all this that God often uses his people that way. We are put under severe trials, and then if we prove ourselves faithful, we become more able to be of use by God in his service. You don't find a person who is used by God who never has gone through trials. In the first place, if you are converted, it is because you have been brought to realize your guilt before God. It must be because you have been deeply convicted of your sin. Then you turn to trust in Christ alone for salvation. Those who have not undergone any deep struggle regarding their sins and their guilt before God, their conversion is very shallow, if they are converted at all. And that's why they have so much to be done in their Christian life. You see, we have to dig deeper, you know, because they seem unbroken people. They are full of pride, they are full of self. You see, that type of people, even if we have no reason to doubt their conversion, we feel that a lot of work is needed. You really have to dig deeper before greater work can be done. So that is the situation with most people. And you discover such people, how can they be useful in the Lord's service? They are of minimal use. Whereas those who have been deeply convicted of their sin, and then when they are soundly converted, you discover they realize they have been forgiven much, therefore they love the Lord much. And you discover that they are more consecrated in their life, they are more committed, and they give up their life to the Lord in their various capacity. Okay? Whatever vocation they hold in life, they live for their Lord. Okay? And similarly, for a child of God to be further used by the Lord, often they have to face trials of making decisions, whether to please themselves or to please the Lord, trials of self-denial, and trials of pain and suffering in their relationship with others, and so on. So various trials make us stronger and more useful in the Lord's service. And this truth we are told in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 4. Well, God who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. So we go through trials, we experience God's help in our life, and we become useful in God's service to help others in a similar situation. But that of course depends on how you went through that trial. Some people went through the trial badly. You see, they lose faith, they kick about, they complain, they just go through the trial very badly. and they finally emerge battered and seeing that God is merciful, but they are not as they did not handle their trials as well as they should. And this is a truth that is also taught by the Lord in Luke's Gospel, chapter 16, verse 10, that those who are faithful in the least will be faithful in much. So if you are put under trial and you keep faith, you discover that in later days God can entrust you with a greater trial. Otherwise, how are you going to stand? So if you are unable to withstand when a smaller trial is placed in your way, so how can you be more useful to God in a bigger trial? So that's why you must learn the lesson from early, that whatever you are given, whether it's responsibility or trials or work by God, you must do well. Prove yourself. Be people of faith. Be people who trust in the Lord. People who want to please the Lord. And you discover that God brings you through that period of trial and you emerge stronger. So all in all, we are going to learn the lesson that God sovereignly places his people under trials to train them for greater usefulness. So we are going to see Mordecai and Esther put under severe trials, but they emerge stronger and become more useful in God's work. So there are these three sections. In verse 1 to verse 11, we see Mordecai, the backslider, undergoing trials. So a backslider's ordeal, verse 1 to verse 11. Then in verse 12 to verse 18, we see Esther, a courageous lady's ordeal. So both went through trials. So that's why we call it an ordeal. They have to go through suffering, go through testing, go through discomfort. So how did they fare? So we see that of Mordecai undergoing trial, and then Esther undergoing trial, and then we see God's merciful hand in their lives and therefore in ours as well. Okay? Verse 19 to verse 23. So let us look at the first section, a backslider's ordeal, verse 1 to verse 11. Now the chapter begins with the king beginning to miss Vashti and knowing that nothing could be done because Vashti had already been removed. So what happened is that the king's servants and those who attended to him put the suggestion that beautiful young ladies, unmarried ladies, should be gathered together from all over the empire to be chosen as the next queen. Now, in the past, the king could only marry by the 7 Persian nobles, the families of that. There were 7 major families in the Persian Empire under whom the king had counsel. So the king would seek counsel from this 7 noble family. But that was done away with by the time of the second king of the Medo-Persian Empire. Darius was the second king. Cyrus, then Darius. Darius did away with that. But you see that this 7 was still very prominent in the empire. Look at chapter 1, verse 14. Those closest to him being Kasina, Sheta, Admatha, Tarshish, Meresh, Masina, Mamukan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. So in the old days, these were the 7 noble families, and the king had to come and consult them, and these 7 noble families will choose one of their relatives to be the king's wife so that she become queen. But that had been done away with. So although they are still the chief counselors of the king, but the king does not have to choose from those 7 families. So instead, there is this empire-wide call for young ladies, beautiful young ladies, to be chosen for this beauty contest. So we think of today's beauty contest and compare with those days. You discover that, you know, how many centuries ago this was already been carried out, but this was specially for the king. And you discover that they had to be beautiful, they have to be virgins, that is unmarried young ladies, and then all the preparations should be made for them to be as in their best before they come to see the king. And the preparation took a total of 1 year. And if you see later on in verse 12, each young woman's turn came to go to the king Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparation for beautifying women. So the preparation was very thorough. For 1 whole year, the women had to be prepared for the competition. And you note that they were placed under this very experienced eunuch by the name of Haggai in verse 3. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel into the women's quarters under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women. So this eunuch, this government officer, was in charge of the women's quarter, and he was the expert and the authority on how to prepare the ladies for the king. Yeah. And it is during this time that we are suddenly introduced to Mordecai. We are told in verse 5, in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. We know that in the days of King David, Saul was from Kish, from the tribe of Benjamin. So here was Mordecai, a descendant of from the tribe of Benjamin. So Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, whom the king of Babylon had carried away. Jeconiah was, of course, the last king in power when the Babylonians attacked and took away the cream of the society. And during that time, you remember Daniel was one of the young men taken away to Babylon to be trained to join the administrative service, the civil service of the king of Babylon. But remember, the Babylonians have fallen and the Medo-Persian Empire had risen. So since those days, people were carried away, they settled there, and Jeremiah the prophet told them, don't fight against your captors. It is God's will that you suffer for your sin. See, the nation of Judah had sinned against God for so many generations. So now God caused the Babylonians to come down and attack, and the cream of the society was taken away to Babylon. And Jeremiah told them, don't fight, remain there. See, a group of people tried to rebel, tried to fight. Jeremiah knew that they wouldn't succeed, and true enough, they didn't succeed, and they finally had to run to Egypt. But these people were told to remain in Babylon, settle there, and you will be there a total of 70 years. Then God will allow you to return. Okay? So we have seen already that the one group of people have returned to Babylon after the 70 years. And we see this described in Ezra chapter 1 to chapter 6. Right? Now, at that time, how many returned? Only about 50,000 people returned. 50,000 might sound many to us, but actually for a nation, who multiplied in Babylon, settled down there, 50,000 was just a small proportion of the Jews who returned. So what happened to the rest? People like Daniel was, of course, too old to come back. But what about the able-bodied people, those in the 40s, in the 50s, who were still able? And what about the new generation who had grown up there? Why didn't they return? Many of them were too comfortably settled in Babylon. They were trading. They attended school there. They grew up there. They did their business there. They were so comfortable with life in Babylon. So many of them had lost faith. Many of them did not want to return with the Jews who were returning to rebuild Jerusalem. So you must see Mordecai in that light, that he was one of those able-bodied people who chose not to follow the exiles to return to Babylon. So straight away, that put a question mark over his faith. This man was a backslidden believer, the person who is supposed to worship Jehovah, but along the way allow his vision of God's kingdom and kingdom work to become blurred. So he was more pursuing a comfortable life in Babylon. Yeah? And because of the place where he stayed and the fact that he was close to the palace, you put all this information together, you discover this man was indeed living a comfortable life. He was in the city of Shushan, and as we have noted, Shushan was the winter capital. The king would withdraw there in winter, and in summer and other parts of the period he would be in Babylon. So this was like a major city, a prosperous city. Mordecai was there, and very soon you discover that Mordecai is closely associated with a palace, which means that he has some connections with the palace people. So he was obviously comfortable, prosperous, and it seems that he had high status in that city. But now he had to face the consequences of his backslidden state. What happened is that we are told that he had raised up this adopted daughter, Esther, who happened to be his uncle's daughter. So it's actually his cousin. So he has raised Esther up as his own daughter. We are told at the end of verse 7, the young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So we see him raising up Esther, and Esther turned out to be a very beautiful lady. So if she turns out to be beautiful, it means that she must be in her late teens already, in a marriageable age, but still fresh and young, young adult. And if you were to look at verse 20, you see that now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. So you see, Mordecai obviously loved Esther much and has paid much attention, invested much time in her upbringing. And she was raised up not only beautiful in looks, but obviously beautiful in her character, in her behavior. She was a very obedient and gracious lady. So from all this information, you see now how this Mordecai was put under the terrible ordeal of having to part with his daughter. What happened is when the king's decree came saying that all beautiful young ladies of what age onwards have to come to the king's palace, Esther was one of those taken. And because it was a decree from the king, nobody could disobey. Yeah. So like it or not, you cannot keep the daughter. So Mordecai had to allow the daughter to go. And he probably comforted himself, saying that perhaps it is for Esther's good. Perhaps it is time that she's grown up and she has to marry anyway. And if she has to marry, why not marry to the king and with the potential of becoming queen? See, in his mind, he must have tried to excuse himself for not holding back Esther. Now, in the case of Vashti, remember, on moral grounds, she made her stand. When the king summoned her to come to parade her beauty before the men, she refused. And she, of course, risked being put to death. And in this case, she was actually removed from being queen. Okay? In the case of Mordecai, a man of faith, we would expect better action than that. And of course, it's easier said than done for us to be placed under such a situation. What would we do? The king's decree has come. So you have a beautiful daughter who falls into that category. She fits the bill and she has to be taken to the palace. So what do? Make a stand, kick up a fuss, and risk being imprisoned at best and probably being put to death at worst. So what do? But remember, if our understanding of the situation is right, Mordecai was a man who had lost faith. He was a backslidden believer. So it follows, therefore, that he would be arguing in himself and trying to justify why he should allow Esther to be taken away. That could be one of the arguments he used. But Esther, after all, is of marriageable age, might as well get married to the king. And even if she's not chosen to be queen, she can be one of the concubines, so better than nothing. So we see he was put into a terrible situation. That's why we call it an ordeal. But the ordeal wasn't over yet. The terrible trial wasn't over yet. Okay? What happened is that Esther was being taken away to be the wife of the potential wife, or if not the queen, if she's not chosen to be queen, she would be a concubine. Yeah? And this king, although from history we know that he was actually quite good-looking man, but nevertheless he was a pagan. And according to the Jewish belief, you don't marry an unbeliever. And Nehemiah in his time made it very plain. Those who had married unbelievers were to separate from them. You remember how Nehemiah even tore the hair off some of the people who were adamant. Nehemiah was really a fiery reformer. If you turn a little bit to the earlier book, Nehemiah chapter 13, and you look at verse 23 there, we read in Nehemiah 13 verse 23, "In those days I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, pulled out their hair, made them swear by God, saying, 'You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves.'" So, of course, from the spiritual point of view, we are not to marry a non-believer. And this becomes clear in the New Testament. Right? It's not so much race. Race doesn't count. We are all descendants of Adam and Eve. So whatever ethnic background you take pride in belonging to, in the end, you discover there's no pure race anywhere. We all have been mixed somewhere along the line. And if you trace our history, you discover we came down from Adam and Eve. So that is not the issue. The issue is more whether you are a believer, you are worshipping the true God or not. And in the New Testament, this is made clear in this 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, we are told. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, in verse 14, we are told, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. What fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness?" This is a general principle that applies to all types of relationship. But the closest possible relationship between two humans on this earth is the marriage relationship. And so it applies particularly to marriage. That is why through the centuries, Christians have always applied this to marriage. A believer should not be unequally yoked in marriage to an unbeliever. So when you begin to court a non-believer, the church has to intervene and call you in and say, "What's happening?" See? But sometimes things are not so clear. The person profess faith, see, and seems to do the right things. And this is where you think that the person is a believer, but as you get to know the person better, you come to realize that he or she is only nominal, in name only a Christian, but not truly converted. Then in obedience to God, you have to break away. Okay? So it might be painful, but it is for your good. Yeah? Because you will never get on well together. Out of romantic love now, you still insist on getting married, then the whole of your married life, you become unhappy. You want to reach that? See? And you say, oh, maybe the person will be converted later. But the fact is that you are disobeying the teaching of the Bible. So how can you expect God to bless you when you disobey such a teaching? Okay? So back to the book of Esther. Mordecai here broke this rule of allowing the daughter to marry an unbeliever. But because that unbelieving suitor is the king himself, Mordecai finds that he is unable to protest. And then you note that the circumstances of the marriage is quite a degrading one. It is not a proper marriage, as it were. You are actually taken in and for the king to test, you see. And one by one, the king would choose which one he likes. Then those whom he has tested, all would be his concubines, you see. So we are going to see more of that in a moment. But the point is that Mordecai knew that this was what was going to happen. So all in all, we discover that this backslidden man was unable to bear good witness. And that is often what happens when you are backslidden. You are not a shining light in the world. See, people look at your life. They are not attracted to the Christian faith. They are not drawn a step closer to the Lord Jesus Christ by observing your life. So this is the direct effect of those who are backslidden. And furthermore, he is so afraid of being known to be a Jew, so afraid of being known to worship Jehovah, so he keeps telling his daughter Esther to keep secret her identity and the relationship with him. So that way it minimizes the chance of Esther being found out, because if people know that Mordecai is a Jew, then they will link Esther, your daughter, therefore she's a Jew. So by trying not to show that they are related, and by hiding the fact that they are Jews and worshippers of Jehovah, Mordecai actually is showing characteristics of a backslidden man. Imagine, you see, you don't want people to know you are related to anybody in the church. You pretend that you don't know anybody in church in the presence of your friends. See? And that is already bad enough. Let us say, you know, you want to hide not only your relationship, but not hide only your faith, but also your relationship to your loved ones, as in the case of Abraham and Sarah. No, that is very bad. You remember the time when Abraham said to Sarah, when anybody asks, you say, you are my sister. You see, now that is not good, you see, when you come to the point of having to hide your relationship like that. So all in all, you come to see that the Mordecai had to go through this ordeal of struggling what to do, and he ended up making all these decisions that characterize more a backslidden man. He was behaving more like an unbeliever than a believer. So the daughter was taken in to the palace to be one of those to be tested by the king. So in verse 11, we read how worried he was. We are told, and every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Okay. So much for not making a stand for what is true and what is right. Okay. And we summarize the lesson we need to learn. We can only expect inconsistencies and compromises in backsliders like Mordecai. And of course, there is a price, a heavy price to pay for compromise. You lie once, you have to lie two times to cover up and so on. Then you have more problems of conscience. See? You hide here, you hide there, every time you're hiding. See? Nicodemus have to hide the fact that he was a follower of Jesus Christ. Then, you know, he had to hide again. But finally, when the Lord died, from the human point of view, it was just too late. You see, how could he bear good witness now? So he was one of those who finally, and you can imagine, with a very heavy heart, a sad heart, went to collect the body of the Lord Jesus Christ. Yeah? And of course, in the providence of God, things turn around, and we believe that Nicodemus was one of those who was happy to discover the Lord risen later on. But the point is that we need to learn from his life as well. Nicodemus tried to hide his faith from the other Pharisees, with the result that he missed out on the opportunity of bearing good witness for his Lord. So when we compromise on our faith, we bring a lot of trials on ourselves and a lot of trials on our loved ones. So you look at the case of Lot. Remember Lot separated from Abraham? And he ended up facing troubles in later days. You turn with me to the first book of the Bible, Genesis. Genesis. And then turn to Genesis chapter 13. Chapter 13. Remember that Lot's workers had quarreled with Abraham's workers, and so the two men realized that their family were just getting into one another, so they had to part ways. And in verse 10, Lot, chapter 13 of Genesis, verse 10, and Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. And Lot, in later days, had to struggle over his faith, because Sodom and Gomorrah were filled with people who were so godless. So his faith was really tested. We know from the New Testament that righteous Lot had to be tested in his faith. Then remember, his daughters were married to unbelievers. And then when the angel of death wanted to strike the city, and then they thought that Lot was joking, you know, that the city was going to be destroyed. Yeah? They thought it was a joke. Yeah? And then when this Lot dragged his two daughters into the mountains and hid in the cave, when everything was over, see what the daughters did? They were prepared to cause the father to be drunk and to make the father have children through the two daughters. You see, now this shows how decadent, how low the Lotus have sung to. And they claim that there were no people around, they had to propagate the race, but this was just an excuse. We know that from the mountain that they could see the plain, that there were so many people, and they knew also their granduncle, so Lot's uncle was Abraham, their granduncle was not too far away. They knew their family and relatives were not too far away. So the two daughters were just giving excuses. So Lot, in choosing to the attractions of the world, brought trouble upon his own faith and brought trouble upon his family. And with time, you discover that the family declined spiritually. Okay. So all in all, we must be careful. Spiritual decline not only affects us, but it affects those close to us. So Mordecai is an example of such a backslidden believer who had to go through such trials. Then we consider verses 12 to 18, courageous lady's ordeal. Now we see the explanation of how these ladies were prepared for the king to taste one by one each night. See? And to them, the natural beauty of the person was not enough. They had to go through this 1 year of regimented preparation. For 6 months, you must undergo certain type of treatment. Another 6 months, you undergo another type of treatment. And you discover that today's Miss Universe contest also don't take that long of preparation, but in those days they prepare so thoroughly. Then one by one, the ladies will be summoned in by the king just to fulfill his lust. And you see in verse 14, we are told there, in verse 14. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women. So it's no more returning to the first house, because she has been enjoyed by the king. Huh? The king has slept with her. So she now becomes a concubine. Yeah? So she goes to the second house, taken care no more by Haggai the eunuch, but by this other man, Shasgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. Okay? So that was how it was done. So all in all, it was not a very pleasant thing that she had to go through. But what could she do? Her own adoptive father had not made the stand for her, and now she ended up in a situation like that. Yeah? And once you become a concubine, you might not come out again. You might not marry and have your own family, because you belong to the king, and the king might not see you again. It's up to his fancy. If he likes you, then he might call you by name. Then you call, come. And imagine how many hundreds of concubines the king has, and the likelihood of you living a normal married life is nearly zero, you see. So that was the situation with the concubines of the king at that time. And we see indications that Esther was a godly lady who couldn't help herself, because she was placed under a situation like that. The circumstances were so difficult that she ended up in a situation like that. But we can see that she was a godly lady from a number of indications. Now, for one thing, we note that she was well raised up and very obedient to lawful authority. She was obedient to her adoptive father, Mordecai. Mordecai, as we have seen earlier, for example, if you look at verse 20 again, now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. So she was so obedient to the father. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. So it was not on that occasion out of fear of the king's decree, but all her life, in her growing years, she has been a very obedient lady. And you discover that along the way, she was favored by the people. And you may argue that it's because she was so beautiful, everybody was stricken by her beauty. But it was more than just beauty, because as you can see, the verse 9, now the young woman pleased him, Haggai, the one in charge, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparation for her besides her allowance. That means she got special treatment from this officer called Haggai. And you note that when she was called in by the king, she followed the instructions of this man, Haggai, who knew better. This man, of course, knew what would please the king and what she should bring along and what she shouldn't bring along. So she followed exactly his instruction. And as it turned out, things worked out well. Yeah? You look at verse 15, and when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abigail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go in to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, advised. Okay? She followed the advice of this person. And then you note that later on, when the big challenge came to her faith, when Mordecai had recovered from his backslidden state, and he was awakened to the realization that the Jews, not only he himself was in danger, the Jews throughout the empire was in danger of being killed. He challenged his daughter to do something. And if you turn to chapter 4 briefly and look at verse 15, chapter 4, verse 15, Esther sent the message to her father, saying in verse 16, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So she asked for prayer and fasting from all the Jews in Shushan, and she and her maid would pray and fast. To pray and fast to pray is already an important indication that she is a woman of faith. To want to fast is an indication that she really is going to appeal to God to intervene. And to fast with such severe total fast, 3 days, 3 nights without food, that is the maximum, the limit, you see, is an indication of how severely tested she was, and she was still exercising faith in God. And then to be willing to die if need be shows that she is really a woman of faith. So we believe that she not only had physical beauty, she not only had beauty in character, but she also had beauty in her spirituality. Okay? And all in all, no wonder she was so well liked by people. In verse 9, we have noted already, the moment she arrived there, she was well liked. And in verse 15, you discover that she was well liked. And we have noted already how obedient she was to Mordecai and how obedient she was to Haggai. And all in all, we seem to see here that she was under a difficult situation. It wasn't because she lacked faith. It wasn't because she was disobedient to God. It's only the circumstances that prevented her from behaving better. So in what ways could she have behaved better? Now, one way she could have behaved better was to abstain from food offered to idols. And we know from the book of Daniel that the food eaten in the pagan courts were offered to idols. It was a known thing in those days. They make a big show of offering food to the idols, and then those food would be eaten. That's why Daniel and his friends refused to take the food of the palace. In Daniel chapter 1, verse 8, we read of that. So in the case of Esther, she did not make a fuss about it. And then we note that when she was taken in, she did not protest like Vashti. And we have to draw the conclusion is because Mordecai was the one more responsible than her. She was under his guardianship. So if the father did not prevent her from being taken in, what do you expect? Perhaps she should still protest. Okay? But you would have made life difficult for Mordecai. So we would say that she could have done better, but she, under the circumstances, couldn't help the situation. And then when taken in to spend the night with the king, she had no choice already. She's already in the situation. Okay? And so all in all, we have to say that she underwent a terrible ordeal. But given the situation, that was the best she could do. Okay? She could perhaps only comfort herself with the knowledge that perhaps she would be chosen to be the queen. And then that would be good, but if not, she would end up being one of the concubines. Huh? So all in all, we conclude that Esther could have done better by making a stand for her faith. But given the situation, we really have to give her the benefit of the doubt and draw the conclusion that she went through that ordeal out of the circumstances, not because of her choice. Okay? Then we see how God intervened in the whole situation. There is a clear third section starting from verse 19 onwards. We are told that the king called for another round of choosing choosing some people, perhaps a standby queen. For whatever reason, we do not know why this second round of choice was made. But by that time, we discover Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now this expression, sat within the king's gate, indicates that he has risen to a position of power. He has become some sort of a judge, some sort of a palace official. Now you can see that this is the case by comparing with the book of Daniel. If you turn further on into the Old Testament to the prophet Daniel, we come to chapter 3, Daniel chapter 3. Look at verse 2. we are told, and King Nebuchadnezzar sent word together to set traps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So you see here, these are the important officials who were summoned. And then you look at chapter 2, verse 49. You see, as Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of the Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Now, to sit in the gate of the king means that he is a higher official. He is higher even than his three friends. Okay? So all in all, what we want to say is that the expression to sit in the gate means to be a high official. And Mordecai at this time had become a high official. And providentially, while being a high official, he discovered that two other officials were planning to kill the king. So Mordecai reported it to Esther, and Esther reported it to the king. And in those days, when you lodge a report, you have to follow certain procedures. Just like today, you don't just simply accuse someone. You have to go to the police station, and the policeman will tell you to fill in a form, or he will sit in front of a computer nowadays and straight away key in for you and print it out to see whether you're satisfied with that, the report, and then you sign. Okay? So in those days, a record of any report like that has to be made. Then procedures have to be followed whereby such a report will be investigated. And it was investigated, and it was confirmed that these two men were committing treason against the king. These two men were actually planning to murder the king. And so since it was confirmed, these two men were hung in the gallows. They were hung until they died. And Mordecai was, as it were, commended. There's this book in which was written, oh, it was Mordecai who reported this. And so then the book was closed. Yeah? We are going to find later on, this book was going to be opened at God's timing. And it's going to be critical in changing the situation around. Okay? So this point here is noted for us, so that in a later chapter, we are going to remember what happened. So all in all, things worked out to the favor of Esther and Mordecai. Esther was chosen to be the queen, and Mordecai now comes to a position of influence in the palace. So these two persons are going to play a crucial role in rescuing God's people from certain death. So we shall see how things develop later on. So all in all, we see this clear three clear sections. Mordecai had to go through this ordeal of worrying for the daughter. Then Esther, a godly lady, had the ordeal of having to obey her father, and also had to obey the king's decree and to be placed under such a situation which any godly young lady would not want to be in. See? But what could she do given the circumstances? Then God turned the situation around such that Esther was chosen to be the queen, and Mordecai came to a position of influence, and together these two are going to work in the palace to be used by God for his purpose in the time to come. Okay? So we draw to a conclusion. What are some of the things we must learn? Firstly, we must learn that we must be committed to God and to his cause. And in so doing, we must not allow worldly values to come and hinder us from doing what is right and pleasing to our God. If we allow worldly values to influence us, or if we fail to do what is pleasing to God, instead we please ourselves, we come to realize that we will be full of anxieties, trials, and heartaches. Then related to that is obedience to his will alone will bring blessing and happiness. We must watch out against temporary gains that cannot be compared with a clear conscience and eternal blessedness. It is good to have a clear conscience before God and before man. It is good to remember that we may suffer now, but God will reward us in the time to come. A life that is clear of a bad conscience is really a blessed life indeed. Okay? Then we must learn to trust God in any apparent uncertainties of life. God is at work in everyday affairs of men to fulfill his purpose. In the case of Mordecai and Esther, you discover that they failed, yes. And they were tight, their hands were tight. They could only operate within certain very tight parameters. They had no freedom, no to choose situation, the situation to favor themselves. They could only work the best within that very difficult situation. And yet God was at work in their lives. And we are going to see how wonderfully God turned things around to their favor and to the favor of his people. So all in all, we note that the lesson we need to carry with us overall is that God sovereignly places his people under trials to train them for greater usefulness. So are you undergoing trials of any kind? Understand this, that you must be faithful in the trial. Go through the trial well, so that in due time God will bless you and use you. Will there be future trials that we are going to face? All who are committed to God, all who to live to please the Lord, they are bound to face with trials of various kinds. But we can rest assured that the Lord will be with his people. See? And the Lord will strengthen us and give us sufficient grace to go through whatever trials. So with that, we come to the end of this talk. Are there questions or comments?